TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Stolen Elections. Mark Crispin Miller is professor of media studies at New York University and the author of the book Fooled Again: How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They Will Steal the Next One Too, Unless We Stop Them. In part one of this two-part program, Mark Crispin Miller described a meeting with John Kerry before the 2004 elections. Miller tried in vain to convince Kerry that the 2000 election had been stolen and that the spread of the electronic voting machines was a major factor. When Kerry runs and wins, or rather loses, the election, he concedes hastily. That concession by Kerry and the Democratic Party leadership, says Miller, was just as catastrophic as the theft of the election by the Republicans. In the fall of 2005, Miller meets John Kerry again. Miller's book, Fooled Again, had just been published. Here is Mark Crispin Miller.
I met with Kerry a second time on October 28th, and he was much, much more receptive this time. No, I'm serious. I said, "You were robbed, Senator, okay?" And he said, "I know." And he started to complain, you know, with some vehemence about the fact that his fellow Democrats on the Hill won't discuss it with him. And he says, "They're all in denial." I said, "And I need evidence. I mean, I've got to give them evidence. Is there evidence in your book?" And I said, "Yeah, there's plenty of evidence in the book. In fact, there is only evidence that Bush lost. There is no evidence that he won." This is true. Other than the official numbers, you know, like the official numbers in Oceania, you know what I mean? The official numbers under Brezhnev. Other than the official numbers, there's no evidence that Bush won. I said this to Kerry. So, then I said, "And there's a GAO report." Now, how many of you heard about that? GAO report?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the Government Accountability Office, right? This is not, they're not exactly Sandinistas, right? I mean, this is bipartisan. They do research for Congress. They come out with this killer report in mid-October listing three major reasons why these machines are untrustworthy. And the coverage? What coverage? It wasn't covered at all, right? But I mentioned it to him as if to say, yeah, there was that too. And he said, "Oh, the GAO had a report?" Yes, really. Now, this raises another issue that we should be thinking about, you know, which is where do they get their staff? Now, I mean, that's a serious question. I wanted to say to him, "What, is your staff in a coma?" I didn't say that. I said, "Yes, the GAO report." So then I said, "Look, you know, you should follow your own lead. What you did with the BCCI scandal and Iran-Contra, he led these investigations in the Senate, which I think were great. I think that's his best work in the Senate." I said that to him. "In that spirit, you should lead an investigation of this." He said, "Well, you know, somebody should do that. I mean, I got the sour grapes problem." I said, "Yes, that is a problem. But trust me, if you read the evidence, if you just study up on this, you will be able to say," and then I basically wrote a speech for him, "that, you know, you didn't want to believe it. You conceded in good faith, but you've been studying it ever since, and you regretfully come to the conclusion that something's seriously wrong here, and it's not about your political career. It's about the integrity of American democracy." I mean, that seems to me to be pretty powerful. So he's nodding, and we parted on excellent terms. We did. He socked me on the arm, you know, and he gave me a thumbs up. Incredible. That really happened. And I went out for a pass, you know, and was pushing my luck. So I was really pleased that, geez, this is great. You know, I mean, Democracy is just around the corner. So my book tour began the Tuesday after, and I started to tell this story in the bookstores because it had a bracing effect on people. I mean, bracing either in, oh, great, or why didn't he say this before? Still bracing, right? Whether they were mad at him or whether they were relieved, it was better than being demoralized and depressed because you're surrounded by a non-existent majority of theocratic lunatics. Okay? They're not there. It's just nothing there. So then I was in Democracy Now. Okay. All right. You like that show? Ask them to cover this issue a little more, okay? Because this show, which is last November, it's the last time they've dealt with it. Okay? This is a left problem, too. The Nation? Who reads The Nation? Yeah. Okay. They haven't uttered a peep about this issue since Election Day. They won't deal with it except to laugh at people who suggest there's evidence that it was stolen. That's David Corn's position. So, you know, you like Mother Jones, you like The Progressive, you like The Nation, you like these magazines, ask him, what's the matter? What's the matter, Michael Moore? What's the matter, Alexander Coburn? What's the matter, Noam? Noam Chomsky is dead set against discussing this. He thinks it's a complete distraction, it's irrelevant, the problems are much deeper than election fraud and so on. Okay. Yeah, okay. Democracy Now. I tell the story. Amy gets all excited. The producers sent out a press release, and within hours, Kerry's office categorically denied that he'd had the conversation with me. Right? That we know that Professor Miller's trying to sell a book. You know, this kind of crap. Like nasty. He did give the senator the book, but none of this conversation took place. This is why I tell this story. It's not about him. It's not important. It's not about me. He's a politician. He's timid. He's vain. So what else is new? The fact is that that response of his was exquisitely irrational, and it tells us something. Because here's a guy who understands from the neck up that he was robbed. Because he's a smart guy. And you really have to be in big mental trouble not to see that he was robbed, as far as I'm concerned. But he sees it. He gets it from here up, okay? He tells me that his fellow Democrats are in denial. And then when the word of that conversation becomes public, he goes into denial himself. How strange is that? Now, I tell the story because it's absolutely characteristic of the National Democrats now. Absolutely characteristic of them. Some of my favorite politicians become, some of the smartest and most progressive politicians, let's say, become peculiarly dim-witted and sort of conservative on this issue. Bernie Sanders. We all love Bernie. Great guy, smart guy, progressive guy. This is his line on the election. We can't talk about this, because if we talk about this, it'll depress Democratic turnout. Well, this is a common line. This is what, you know, many people in the Democratic... Thank you. Thank you for that ray of common sense. What good does it do to vote? See, right? Okay, reply to the logic this way. Oh, all right then. All right, you're right. Let's not talk about it. Let's make sure that Democratic turnout is really high. Let's make sure it's 100%. That way, when all their votes get stolen, they'll really be demoralized. They'll never vote again. Right? Great idea. Great. See, you know, with all due respect to Bernie and to the Democrats who basically say the same thing, that betrays a distrust of the people. See, let's keep it from them. They're too dumb to understand the nuances. They will just not vote. They're so dumb that we have to keep this a secret. They're not anti-democratic. They're not stupid. Bernie understands. This is denial. This is why Kerry suddenly turned around like on a dime when the word became public, because he says to himself, shh, I have to deny that this conversation took place. because otherwise people will hammer me for being a conspiracy theorist and a sore loser. That's his conscious reason. But think about it. If he understood and accepted the fact that the election was stolen, would he care if he gets hammered for being a sore loser? I mean, wouldn't he have an appropriate sense of emergency? Right? So wouldn't Bernie Sanders, if he really understood and accepted that the race was stolen, wouldn't he say, you know, it's really not a matter of the turnout. People have got to be included in this conversation because this is a democracy. We have to fix the system. If we don't fix the system, we've got nothing. We've got no single-payer health care plan. We got no peace in Iraq. We got no sound environmental policy. We got no reproductive freedom. We got nothing. We got nothing, but we'll be a nation of serfs. Now, one last example. At the end of my book tour, I was taking the train home from D.C., and there in the club car is my congressman, Jerry Nadler. Great guy. I love this guy, right? And there he is, populist that he is. He's talking to the train crew and kicking back, telling stories about the cloakroom, you know, and all this Senate, you know, House cloakroom. So I went up to him, gave him the book. He said, yeah, I saw that. I said, I'm the author. Oh, yeah, how are you? So I said, listen, can I talk to you for a few minutes? He said, sure. So I said, listen, what are the Democrats doing? You know, it's November. What are they doing about election reform? We've got an off-year election next year. He said, well, look, Bush won Ohio by what, 400,000 votes? So he would have won anyway. Now let me tell you why it took every ounce of my concentration not to fall over on the floor when he said this. Right? Why it was hard for me to remain sitting up. Not only is Nadler a smart guy, but he's on the House Judiciary Committee. That means he worked on the Conyers report. That means he studied Ohio. That means he has to know somewhere inside that Bush won Ohio by 118,000 votes, not 400,000. Why did he quadruple the number? Because it's a rationale. He couldn't change the subject fast enough. Now, and I understand this, okay? I understand it completely. I mean, when we're confronted with something as enormous as this, as dire as this, it's only natural that we're going to say, no, it's crazy. That's crazy. They wouldn't do that. Why not? What in Bush Cheney's record could possibly lead us to think that they wouldn't do that? You mean their stalwart championship of democracy in Haiti? Right? Their stalwart championship of democracy in Venezuela? Their stalwart championship of democracy in Europe, where the countries whose governments listened to their populations were dismissed as old Europe? Remember this? Right? For their stalwart championship of democracy in Iraq, where there's no press freedom and Jay Bremer basically wrote the legal system for them? That's because, right? Because of the way they handled Katrina? Is that why we think they wouldn't steal an election? But it's hard to accept, just as it was hard to accept the Holocaust. It's not that different. Because back then in the 30s, the Social Democrats acted exactly the way our Democrats are acting now. People had their hair on fire. They'd be saying, this is a disaster. This is really going to be destructive. This is dangerous. A lot of people would say, calm down, will you? Just calm down. Let's be reasonable. Now, he's a politician. Hitler is a politician. He's a very clever politician. I've talked to him myself. He knows what he's doing. He has to say those things to appeal to his followers. But he's much smarter than that. Basically, he wants to build Germany up, wants to strengthen the economy, and he wants to stand as a bulwark against Soviet communism, and this is all fine. That's what he's really doing. It's okay. All these stories about the Jews, forget it. That's crazy. This has happened all the time. And it's perfectly natural. Unfortunately, it's all too human. It's all too human. The philosopher Alistair MacIntyre calls it an epistemological crisis. And something is profoundly upsetting. Because if you accept it, then you have to draw other inferences that take you where you don't want to go. If they stole the election, that means we don't live in a democracy anymore. If they stole the election, it doesn't make a dime's bit of difference who you run. You could run Jesus Christ himself. He comes back down, he gives the Sermon on the Mount, he's telegenic, you know, he gets a good necktie. He's the perfect candidate. He connects with the people, he does miracles, and you'll still lose. That's scary. And I think that that's particularly scary for people who are invested in the system. See, I don't have any trouble at the grassroots level making this stuff clear to people. I just don't. Turnout's always been great. Response has been great. When people hear about the book, they buy it, and they do exactly what I hoped they would do. They tell their politicians about it. They tell the media about it, and they try to hammer on them and hammer on them and get the word out. Because there's no substitute for democratic action, finally. And until this becomes a mass movement, it's not going to get anywhere. It has to get out there. It absolutely has to get out there, okay? All this stuff, you know, that they think about, from the message, the candidate, and all this that's irrelevant. And most of them, you know, I've noticed in the Democratic Party, can't talk about politics in any other terms. It's a big game to them. So they can't deal with it. They can't see it. You mention it, it goes in one ear and out the other. The press is the same way. And the left press is the same way. Because let's be brutally honest, shall we? You know, a lot of people who write for the left are freelancers. They have families to support. And we're all skating on very thin ice these days. We're like a whisper away from pauperization. There's no moral superiority here. I can only do this because I have tenure. Seriously. If I didn't have tenure, I wouldn't do it. So here's what I think. This is not a left-right issue. This is a civic issue of profound importance. It is the crucial issue. And anyone with a progressive bone in his or her body has got to recognize that this comes first, or you're not going to get anywhere with anything else. Okay? And I'll tell you something else. This is not a policy issue. What we need and what we will eventually do is to go to paper ballots and count them by hand. Now, that's what we will eventually do. It's like we'll eventually be out of Iraq. We're going to eventually hand count paper ballots. It may be politically difficult to get that now. So we got to take a leaf from the far right. They're not going to start agitating today for a ban on abortion, you know, stamp out condom use and all that. They do it much more indirectly and incrementally, and that's what we have to do with electronic voting machines. It's going to have to be gradual. But the policy we ultimately should be aiming for is hand-counted paper ballots. We should also be demanding a uniform standard for voting procedures nationwide. Right? We also need instant runoff voting. Right? We also need to make it illegal to be a Secretary of State and a co-chair of a political campaign. And we need a total ban on the participation of private vendors in our electoral system. Right? I mean, that much is simple. That's the policy, the list of policies we should be shooting for. That's like the ideal policy list. But this is not a policy issue. My friends, this is something far larger than that. Because the problem isn't just that there's a certain amount of incompetence in counting the vote. I love that argument. A lot of mistakes are made, and people are just stupid. And all right, so 98% of the mistakes happen to benefit one party over the other. No fraud there. If we don't focus on the fraud, we're going to miss the whole point. And if we miss the whole point, we're not going to succeed. It is not a policy issue. It is a profound civic issue that has to do with an essential threat to the very nature of the American system. This is an Enlightenment issue. This country is the finest fruit of the Enlightenment. It exists in a reason-based universe, and it's predicated on the assumption that power will always try to destroy human freedom. Now, the reason why Democrats and people in the press and others laugh off or try to laugh off the claim of election fraud is because they're saying to themselves, it can't happen here. Now, I would like to know where that idea came from. It can't happen here. You know, we have the form of government we have precisely because it can happen here. The framers understood from studying history that it can always happen anywhere. So we have checks and balances, right? We have separation of powers, right? We have a Senate and a House, right? We used to, right? All that's been subverted now. A free and independent press is a check on government power, right? Habeas corpus, right? Freedom of speech, right? Separation of church and state, right? Well, why would anybody, any member of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, apologize for a second about defending the separation of church and state? Was this something we have to tap dance away from? Is this something that Hillary has to tell us to get over? We should all act really religious so they'll vote for us? I mean, study a little American history, okay? The separation of church and state was a joint creation of the rationalist framers who distrusted religious zealotry and a whole lot of very pious American Christians who understood, because they were smart enough to understand, that if there were a state church, they would be persecuted by it, right? Can we just look back on our own past? Can we just reconnect with our own revolutionary heritage? I think that would be a cool thing to do. I really do. Now, let's be brutally honest here. You know, the left's intellectual models come from Europe. You know, we're still fighting the Cold War. I got news for you. The Cold War is over. This is not the long twilight struggle between capitalism and communism, between socialism and communism. Understand this. Both socialism and capitalism are products of the Enlightenment. They're both Enlightenment doctrines. We have all been thinking that the Enlightenment was a done deal. We were wrong. I mean, the things that we take for granted, like the importance of reason, evidence, proof, logic, things like that, that doesn't fly anymore. See? So it's not something we can, you know, framing, arguing, logic, it has nothing to do with it. There is a profound assault going on now, an assault on the very ideals on which the creation of the American Republic were based. I fully understand that those ideals were traduced, even at the time, in the most grotesque ways by slave owners and through the Indian genocide. That does not invalidate the ideals. That simply indicates the historical difficulty of realizing them on Earth. It takes forever. It's a long, slow, arduous, painful, bloody, haphazard process. We'd gotten some way there, some slight way there, when this movement seized power. And they're against that. They're completely against that. This is not a left issue, you know? It's not a right issue. It's not about that at all. It's about reclaiming the energy that made this nation possible, reclaiming the energy that drove so many common people, black and white, male and female, during our War of Independence. A lot of those people gave their lives for the revolution. I'm not going to give that up. I'm not going to say, yeah, let the Republicans have it. No way. It's not going to happen. So basically what I'm saying is that we form coalitions. You know, I have learned, and it just kills me to say this, that for the most part, I'd rather have a staunch conservative who believes in reason in the Bill of Rights as my ally than any number of mushy liberals I can think of. Because there are Republicans who actually understand that what's going on is grotesque. Okay, they've been read out of the party, because the party's dominated by the theocratic right. But we basically need to reclaim America here. Because if we don't reclaim America, if we don't ensure ourselves the right to vote and to have our votes be counted, this experiment is finished. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. So what you should be doing, what I implore you to do, is to keep this issue uppermost in your minds, to encourage the leaders of all the different progressive movements to put their weight behind this issue, do everything you can do to make sure that the American people, coast to coast, know the truth about what happened in 2004 and the truth about what's happening now in state after state after state, as the Republicans succeed slowly and inexorably in forcing these machines on the whole country. Can't let that happen. Thank you.
That was part two of a two-part talk on stolen elections by Mark Crispin Miller, author and professor of media studies at New York University. This talk was recorded at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California, on May 4th, 2006. Miller is the author of many books, among them The Bush Dyslexicon and Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. His newest book is Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Go to the newest programs section for a link to Mark Crispin Miller's site. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order really is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.